We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In 1965, the U.S. government enacted legislation to provide health care to low-income people. At first, this program operated in the shadow of Medicare. Now, Medicare, that's the program that provides health care to seniors. But soon, the program that we're talking about, Medicaid, soon that became a very powerful force all on its own. Today, Medicaid is the fourth most expensive item in the federal budget and the second largest category of spending for almost every state. In this hour of focus, we'll be trying to take a look at the history of Medicaid, some of the economic dynamics that have shaped the program now for almost half a century. And our guest is Laura Katz Olson. She is professor of political science at Lehigh University, and she has published widely in a number of fields. Aging. She's written about health care and women's studies. She's written on Medicaid, Medicare, long-term care of the elderly, pensions, Social Security, and also problems experienced by older women. And she is the author of a book that has recently been published that covers the area that we're talking about here this morning. The title of her book is The Politics of Medicaid, and it is published by the Columbia University Press. It's recently out, so if you'd like to read in detail, more detail than I'm sure that we can do in this conversation, you can take a look at the book. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome. We do ask people to just try and be brief as they possibly can, but, of course, questions, comments are welcome on the show. And you can do that in two different ways. You can call, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line, so no matter where you are, use that number, 800-222-9455. And you may also send your questions, comments to email to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you certainly questions, comments are welcome. And Professor Olson, hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate it. There, just to talk about some general points first, and then probably we'll come back and get into these things in some detail. I guess I was very struck by one of the things that you write about early in the book, where you note that a lot of the programs, the government programs that come under the heading of welfare, have come under a lot of criticism, particularly from conservatives. And we're talking about things like, as you note here, things like food stamps and public housing and legal aid and so forth. But interestingly enough, you note that Medicaid really hasn't experienced the same kind of criticism. I don't know if that means that people are positive about it, but at least it hasn't taken the same heat that a lot of these other programs have. And I wonder, why do you think that that is?
Well, that's one of the questions that drove my inquiry into the issues of Medicaid, how it became, as a welfare program, the fourth largest item on the federal budget and the second on state budgets, given that it is a welfare program. Mm-hmm. And one of the conclusions that I came to is that Medicaid really feeds some major stakeholders. For example, nursing homes get almost half of all of their revenues from Medicaid. Hospitals are highly dependent on it. Certainly insurance companies benefit measurably. And these are just some of the companies. You even have Ross Perot's systems that benefits gets millions in computer systems from Medicaid. So there's a lot of very high-stake beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm. And so it's in the interest of those people to see the system continue, and no doubt it was in their interest to see the system grow.
Yes, and indeed it's going to be the major means of expansion in the new health care reform bill. It's going to add something like 16 million more people.
So how just it can you just toss out some numbers, say when Medicaid was created, roughly speaking, how many people were covered and what are we looking at today?
Oh, there was a tiny percentage of people covered. It was mostly meant for the very, very poor. Today, even though it still covers only the very, very poor, there are something like 59 million people covered. It's very hard to get an exact number because people tend to go off and on during a year. It started off as a couple of million dollars, and now the program is $333 billion. So it's one of the major expenses in the country.
And I think probably it's worth picking up the point, just as you said, that I said, and I'm sure that people would say, as a shorthand kind of identification, they say, well, Medicaid is the program that provides health care to poor people. But the fact of the matter is that to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be really poor. I mean, this is the poorest of the poor are the people that we're talking about.
Yeah. The average in the states, and this is really an average, is about 60% of the federal poverty level. Some states go as low as 24% of the federal poverty level. So coverage is very uneven. Now, this, of course, is going to change because the non-elderly across the states will be at 133% of the federal poverty level with the reform bill. But even so, you're talking about very poor people.
Mm-hmm. How many of the people that we're talking about here also are people who are in nursing homes, in long-term care, and that's really what we're talking about? That's where the money is going.
That is one of the most misunderstood aspects of Medicaid. Medicaid covers about one-third of all the money that goes out of Medicaid of the $333 billion. Fully one-third of it goes for long-term care, mostly nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small percentage of the Medicaid participants, but a huge percentage of its costs.
Yeah.
Children are very cheap to insure. It's the elderly who are very expensive.
And if you say, you know, look at the, roughly speaking, the demographics, you ask this question aside from the issue of income level, who is receiving benefits under Medicaid?
Medicaid is that's actually another misunderstood thing about Medicaid. Is Medicaid is mostly a program in terms of coverage for children, pregnant women, and the elderly. There are very few, relatively few adults. Some mothers, depending on the states, very rarely a single person. So it's really mostly for children, pregnant women, and the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's going to change. Because with the health reform bill, it'll cover nearly everyone with 133%.
Is it? I guess just one other sort of general point that you make in the book that, given it's interesting that given the scope of Medicaid and how much money goes into it, that it seems actually not to get a great deal of attention. Or at least if there are problems, maybe that's going to – I mean, I'm not talking about in the news media. If there are problems, there'll be stories. But I'm sure that you're not going to open up the paper one day and see a headline that says, Medicaid works just great. What you're going to see is stories about problems. It seems that it's actually something that probably most of the time most people don't pay a great deal of attention to.
Well, I think there's two things that get the attention of the press and that people will read about. The first one is fraud.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be one of the big issues, and there's constant frauds, constant articles, constant exposés about fraud by some of the major providers. The second thing that will get the attention, and right now is getting a lot of attention, is the fact that the states are having budgetary shortfalls because of the recession. Because Medicaid is It's a combination of the federal government and the state in terms of funding, and you know the federal government can go into deficit, states can't. So right now, most of the states are struggling to pay for their Medicaid benefits, and that's getting some attention.
Our guest this morning, Laura Katz Olson, is professor of political science at Lehigh University and has written in her scholarly work on a number of subjects, including Medicaid, also Medicare, long-term care of the elderly, and Social Security. She's author of a recent book. It's titled The Politics of Medicaid, and it is published by Columbia University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to perhaps have you talk a little bit about how it is that Medicaid came to be. But before doing that, maybe take a step back and I just ask the question, well, before there was Medicaid for very poor people, what was there in terms of any kind of assistance for them to have some health care?
There was some health care for the elderly, for the very poor elderly. There wasn't very much for people who weren't elderly, including children. The real focus of the Johnson administration, and certainly the focus of the Democrats, was to get health care for the elderly. So the Medicare was really the focus of attention. I found it interesting that prior to the passage of Medicare in 1965, there were many, many articles talking about Medicare, talking about the problems, some of the issues, the potential of Medicare. There was hardly any articles talking about Medicaid. People really didn't even know that it was going to be passed. It was a last-ditch effort, and really was viewed as the stepchild of Medicare for the early years.
Well, did people at the time think that it was? Did they ever think that it was going to that it would become as big as eventually it did?
Well, first of all, the short answer is no. The longer answer is I don't think that people gave much thought to Medicaid. It was really an afterthought. One of the issues that's very interesting about Medicaid is that the state started depending on it for their economy. One of the reasons that the states jumped on to the Medicaid bandwagon, so to speak, is because they saw federal dollars coming in. And to this day, they're very reliant on these matching grants or federal dollars. One of the more interesting stories, of course, is New York, which saw right away the benefits of grabbing all these federal dollars. So they immediately jumped in, and they started offering everything that they could to grab as much money as they could from the federal government. So in the early years, New York got most of the Medicaid money from the federal government. So this is an important, I think, concept that the states are very tied to the Medicaid program economically.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. I believe someone who is listening over in Indiana on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. This couldn't happen. One of my questions just fits hand in glove what you're talking about in terms of the states getting the monies from the federal government. That allows the states to set the parameters for who gets Medicaid and things like that. I used to volunteer for helping people fill out forms and stuff at a senior center. And when I found out Indiana, this was some few years ago, but it may still be the same, when Indiana was giving a rent subsidy in terms of finding out how much money you would get or whether you would get Medicaid at all at $250. That just, you know, it wasn't that much in the 80s. And people are paying, you know, $500 on up for rent, but they only get tallied for $250. So when the Medicaid money comes to them, there's no way they can cover the cost of lab analysis, pharmaceuticals, or the doctor's appointment. They have to make a choice like a lot of people do who are trying to make it on their own, like, you know, well, I'll just give up the pills this month or something like that. And that provokes me a lot, but I find out there's practically nothing you can do because here in Indiana, it's controlled by the state, and they like to have those funds for other things, especially in the group we have running the place now, which is sort of like Reaganite Republicans. And it's sort of sad to see this situation happen, especially the children still getting hurt, too, even though this program was started for them. I wonder if you could make a comment about the different states' attitudes and what parameters they use for deciding who is allowed to be on Medicaid. Thank you.
Okay. Can you do that?
Yeah. Well, one of the problems with Medicaid, and this is an issue because it's going to be the mainstay of the reform bill, the expansion of Medicaid to 16 million more people. One of the basic problems is that it is controlled by the states. There are some mandated benefits, but for the most part, states decide which optional benefits that they're going to provide. And each state provides different amounts. Some states will give unlimited drugs. Other states will say you can have 3 drugs a month, prescription medications. Some states are controlling whether you can have dental care. So not only does it differ from state to state, but it also fluctuates within the state. You might get one administration come into power and decide they'll have dental care, and then 4 years later another will come into power and decide we're eliminating dental care. So it's a very unstable system, and it's an inequitable system. And I think the caller is right that it really depends on where you live and not on your medical needs. And this is a serious problem.
Maybe just another general question. It's something that maybe I should have asked right at the beginning when we were talking about how much money goes into Medicaid. The question is, what's the quality of care that people are receiving? How good is it?
Well, I find that this is one of the basic issues that has not been addressed by the health care reform bill and certainly is a huge issue under Medicaid that has not been addressed. For example, studies show that there are differential treatments and outcomes for people who are on Medicaid versus people who have private insurance. Certainly, the quality of nursing homes in the United States is abysmal. You also, for doctors, the quality of care, many of them many Medicaid patients either go to Medicaid mills, which is doctors who just see patient after patient after patient without giving them good care. Others are going to underfunded public hospitals and clinics. Something like 65-70% of all Medicaid patients are now in managed care, and some of them are Medicaid-only managed care organizations, and the care there can be very questionable. One state in particular that's interesting is Florida, where they have mandated managed care in 5 counties, and they're looking to increase it to the entire state. This has been, the governor right now has said they can't do that, but it'll come soon. And the studies show, without doubt, that the managed care in these counties is abysmal. Patients can't find doctors. The care itself is not very good. So there's a lot of questions about the quality of care under Medicaid.
Mm. On to another caller. Let's go to someone local here, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, interesting. Could you comment on the percentages or numbers of long-term care or nursing home that's paid for by Medicare? There was a news story that most of it's maybe 70% is by Medicaid, and then out of pocket But then there's a small amount by insurance and Medicare. But are there any still benevolent associations that run basically charities where they provide care, but there's no billing process, no fees collected? Thanks.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you saying, are there any free nursing homes? Is that the question? Generally, people, in order to get nursing home care under Medicaid, they have to spend all of their money. They have to basically impoverish themselves, and then they have to use all of their income on a monthly basis, and then Medicaid will pay the difference. So, yes, you can get free Medicaid nursing home care if you impoverish yourself, if you have no assets and use all of your available income. I don't know if that answers the question.
And maybe I think maybe sometimes people are confused about this because I think that it is the case that Medicare will pay for some skilled care if people are really ill, but it doesn't pay for, say, long-term custodial care, where people are their basic needs have to be taken care of. But it's not the case that they need some sort of advanced kind of medical treatment or care. So Medicare really doesn't. We have a very significant need for long-term care for people, and Medicare doesn't really contribute. I think hardly contributes anything to that.
Yeah, Medicare will keep people in a nursing home for rehab after hospitalization, 3-day hospitalization, and it will pay for almost unlimited home care after hospitalization. But the key is you have to be improving, and it's only for health care, not for assistance with going to the bathroom or assistance with daily living. So you really need to be improving, and certainly you can't be depending on it for your long-term care needs for the frail elderly.
Hmm.
I think that's misunderstood. People usually think Medicare is a long-term care program, which it isn't.
It's not, yeah. To another caller here up in Geneva, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I was wondering, my mom is 78. My dad was 82. He just passed away last year. And I'll tell you what, from what I've been seeing, the doctor care, it depends on what kind of insurance you are. They play games with people. They figure if you're going to die or if your chances are, 20% or less, they don't want to deal with you because they figure they're going to lose money on it. So they just stick you full of drugs and let you die. There's no real good care. And what I'm worried about is you're talking about states versus, say, going on nationwide health care. If the states can't get it right, what means that the government, the federal government, is going to get it right? I see so many people now that the baby boomer generation starting to retire, and they're starting to come up with a lot more health problems than, say, our generation before did. What boggles my mind is I personally think it ought to be state by state, depending on the situation. Like, for instance, I went down to South Carolina. It's terrible. It's very impoverished. It's like a third world country down there, versus, say, somebody up in Illinois here. You got to play. I guess they're going to have to work out something, but I don't know. I guess what I want to hear is that explain to me which is better as far as Medicaid and Medicare. Would it be better on the federal or the state by state? And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, you have some serious problems when it's based on the state. First of all, it's going to depend on the political will of each governor and state legislature. It's going to depend on the economic viability of each state. So some states have more resources than others. Your health care needs, then, whether they'll be taken care of or not, is not based on how sick you are, but on which state you live in. And the states, of course, have the least ability to pay because of the fact that they can't go into a budget deficit. They're very reluctant to raise taxes. So the states are really, I don't think, the best means for running the and paying for the health care system. I think it has to be national.
Well, did when this whole thing was up for discussion, when Medicaid was created, was this how did it connect with, or did it connect with, any kind of debate at the time about the larger subject of national health?
Well, I think that we've had discussions about national health care on a regular basis. Kind of looks like an oscilloscope. It goes up and down, up and down. Every time it goes up, the expectations that we're going to have national health care. This happened under Truman. It happened under Kennedy. It happened under Nixon. It happened under Clinton, and so on. And then, of course, the expectations drop and we don't get it. In 1965, there was great expectations that we might get national health care, and the compromise was Medicare and less so Medicaid. So really, it was a substitute for national health care.
And so was the idea that you would start with the elderly and the most disadvantaged, and then maybe sometime in the future move on from there?
Well, I think that the liberals were thinking of it as the camel's nose in the tent, that once we got it, it would be expanded to national health care, which, of course, did not happen. The conservatives hoped that it would stop any attempt at national health care, that it would satisfy people, because it did take care of the most vulnerable, the elderly and the very, very poor. Over the years, of course, the elderly started having a stake in Medicare and were very reluctant to expand to national health care. Many of the elderly were afraid of the recent health care reform law because they thought that they may lose something under Medicare.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Laura Katz Olson. She is professor of political science at Lehigh University, has authored a number of books. Many of them have to do with political and economic issues surrounding aging in America. And that is something that she's particularly interested in her research. She's written on Medicare as well as Medicaid, also long-term care for the elderly, pensions, Social Security, problems experienced by older women. And she's the author of a recently published book, which is titled The Politics of Medicaid. And it is published by the Columbia University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And maybe we've been over this ground, but I guess I just want to go back to looking at the early point here, and how is it that, and maybe it for the reasons that you just outlined, that it would have been inevitable that the program would have been geared so much to providing local, essentially to state control, so that you have the situation where every state has their own program, and there's a big difference from state to state. And as you pointed out, the quality of care you receive has a lot to do with where it is that you live. I mean, was it just also a given right from the beginning that that's the way the program was going to be?
Oh, yes. It was clearly lodged in the states. One of the jokes among people who study Medicaid is that if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program. Each one of them is very, very different. And some of the states are quite stingy, and others are much more generous. For example, New York, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and so on, they have very generous programs. And then you have Missouri, Mississippi, Colorado, Idaho, and South Carolina, which have very stingy programs. So you have great variation among the states. It's not just minor differences.
And the federal government doesn't set any, or doesn't set any, does it set any minimum or set a floor to sort of say you must at least provide this level of care, or is it everything up to the state?
Oh, no. There's certain mandated benefits.
Mm-hmm.
but it's the amount that you get that the state decides. The optional benefits, and I use the word optional with very loosely, because dental care I don't consider optional, but it is considered optional under Medicaid. And so the states, some states have very lean benefit packages. This, by the way, is one of the biggest issues that I'm concerned at with the health care reform. Mm-hmm. Because as you expand Medicaid and force the states to take on more eligible people, they will then have the option, which is not talked about a great deal, of cutting the benefit packages even more. So I think as the states become more hard-pressed economically, they are simply going to cut what people are going to get.
So they're going to end up, they'll be responsible for covering more people, and they will cover more people, but the services that it'll be spread out, they'll be less probably spread out over more people.
Exactly. For example, during this recent recession, many of the states are cutting dramatically some of the benefits. Just as an example, California has capped dental care. Nevada has abolished vision care. Utah dropped rehabilitation, hearing, and vision care, and so on. And this is happening almost on a weekly basis. You can read about the states cutting and capping. The states are also raising and will raise the premiums and co-payments as they're obliged to cover more people. So I'm very concerned that coverage is not going to be enough. The second issue I think that's just as important is that the reform bill, while covering many, many more people, I'm not quite sure how they're going to get access to services, particularly doctors. Already it's very difficult for Medicaid patients to find a doctor who will actually treat them. So they may have Medicaid coverage, but many, many doctors do not take the Medicaid patient because of the low fees.
And that seems to go to an issue that it's probably always has been an issue, and that is that the program decides for a particular procedure it will pay X amount of dollars, which seems never really quite has seemed to have been adequate to actually cover the cost of those procedures. And so there are many physicians who will just say, I'm not going to do this because I'm going to lose money on this deal.
Well, I'm not sure they actually lose money on the deal. That I think we can argue, that's arguable. But they do get more money from private pay and Medicare. It's something on average of 85% of, Medicare is about 85% of private pay, while the Medicaid is something like 60 to 70% of private pay. So if a doctor has a choice of which patients he or she is going to take, they will clearly take the private pay and the Medicare patient. Very few are willing, especially specialists, are willing to take the Medicaid patient. Whether they actually lose money on it, I think that's arguable. They're always complaining. Doctors and hospitals and nursing homes, that's the mantra since 1965, that we're losing money on Medicaid patients. I don't think that's the case, actually.
Well, let's talk with someone in Charleston next. Line number four. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, my topic of interest you guys just started to touch on, and I'm sorry if I don't get all my facts straight, but I've heard there's a proposed like 20 to 21% reimbursement cut from, I think it's either Medicare or Medicaid.
That'll be Medicare.
Okay, Medicare. Okay, so that's actually more pertinent. So then the response that I heard was, and I don't know if this is even legal, that some doctors are just going to refuse outright to see Medicare patients then, particularly, as you mentioned, the specialists. Because, I mean, there's just fewer and fewer family doctors, more and more specialists. I think the driving reason is money. Specialists get a ton of money, and they get a ton of money from the treatments that they provide. But if they And this is what I my question is it legal for the physicians to just outright deny someone's service because of the type of coverage they have? I mean, doesn't that totally deflate or even just do away with the value of that Medicare and Medicaid coverage if people don't honor it?
Well,
is that a new problem on the horizon, or has that always been there and we've just kind of gotten around it in the past?
Thank you
very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me clarify. The 20 to 21% cut in Medicare has not happened yet. And it's been threatened now for many, many years, and Congress keeps putting it off every year. So we don't know whether that cut will actually happen. If it does happen, many physicians are threatening that they will drop Medicare patients. As far as the larger issue, doctors do have a choice of whether they're going to take a patient or not. They can drop a patient. They don't have to take new patients. And they can serve patients based on the kind of insurance they have. So, yes, they can legally not take a Medicare patient. That has not been a problem for two reasons. One is that the fees are relatively high, about 85% of private pay. And two, because the elderly tend to be the ones in need of Medicare the most, it would be very difficult to keep a full patient load and not take any Medicare patients. Medicaid, on the other hand, which is a much lower percentage in fees based relative to private pay. Many, many doctors do not take Medicaid patients, and they're not legally required to. If they already have a Medicaid patient, most of them will keep them, and they won't take new patients. So this has been a problem right from the beginning, from 1965, finding physicians who will take and treat Medicaid patients. This is one of the biggest problems.
If I might ask a follow-up question, is part of the solution possibly to get more physicians into the family practice type of medicine? Because that seems like that would lower a lot of costs. It would, I mean, specialists, I'm not trying to portray them as part of the problem, but maybe I am.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the health care reform bill is going to pay family physicians a greater fee for 2 years with the hope that it'll attract more to take Medicaid patients. My concern is what's going to happen after the 2 years because the states would then be responsible, and I don't think the states will continue that. The second issue, I think, is, yes, I think we need more family medicine. We need more general practitioners. And I think my biggest criticism, or one of my biggest criticisms of the health reform bill, is that it's not doing enough to add more doctors to the mix. I think we need more medical schools. We need more residencies. And we need to really have many, many more physicians in this country. I think it's been too restricted at this point.
Well, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We have about 10 minutes left, again, in this part of Focus. Just quickly, our guest is Laura Katz Olson. She's professor of political science at Lehigh University. She's author of the book, The Politics of Medicaid. It's recently published by the Columbia University Press. She has written on a number of subjects, Medicaid being one, also Medicare, long-term care of the elderly, Social Security, pensions. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a question here. It has come in as an email, and I hope that there's enough information here for you to answer. The listener is interested in the Federal Partnership Act. The person writes that it allows an individual to shelter some assets from Medicaid if you buy long-term care insurance.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think the listener wonders, do you think that that would harm Medicaid? They do ask a question specifically about Illinois joining the program. Now, I don't know, you're in Pennsylvania, so I don't know that you would really know about Illinois, but can you talk about this?
Yeah, this is a long-standing program that four states had joined. I know New York was one of them. And then it was decided that no more states could join it. Now it's been opened up since 2005. Hmm. It's been opened up to any state that wants to join. And essentially what it is it allows people to buy long-term care insurance in a partnership. I was never sure why they expanded it because it hasn't been very successful. In particular, it has cost the Medicaid program even more money, and it's allowed people to shelter money, essentially. So it hasn't been a very successful program in terms of the point of the program was to try to cut Medicaid costs, and it hasn't done that. So I'm not even sure why the rest of the states are joining it, given how unsuccessful it's been.
Very well. Other questions are welcome. And again, I say we have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested in going back to the subject of who it is that actually makes money off of Medicaid. We talked just a moment ago about the fact that there are physicians that either severely limit the practitioners who severely limit the number of Medicaid patients they take because they say the reimbursement just isn't adequate to providing the services. And as you argued, there's, in fact, no legal requirement that any physician take somebody who is on Medicaid. But you also talked right at the beginning about the fact that there has, for a long time, been support for Medicaid among people in the healthcare industry, particularly we're talking about nursing homes, hospitals, insurance companies. So even given the fact that maybe some people would argue that the reimbursement isn't what it should be, who has made money off of Medicaid?
Well, I think you first of all have to start with the nursing home industry. The nursing home industry is entirely dependent on Medicaid. It would collapse without Medicaid. As I said earlier, they get something close to 50% of all their revenues from Medicaid. They get something like 12% of their revenues from Medicare. I'm not quite sure of that figure, but I know they get at least half from Medicaid. So they're dependent on Medicaid, and it's an important part of their well-being. Hospitals rely on Medicaid to fill their beds. They're constantly arguing, every state hospital association constantly argues how they're losing money on Medicaid. The reality is that they can fill their beds with Medicaid, and they're dependent on Medicaid to a great extent. Obviously, the insurance companies are very dependent, especially the Medicaid-only insurance companies that have cropped up. They are 100% reliant on Medicaid. The drug companies get a huge percentage of their income from Medicaid, so they profit from it. Your durable medical equipment, I don't know if you've ever seen advertisements for wheelchairs and mm-hmm. other kinds of durable equipment. Mm-hmm. They get a great deal of money from Medicaid as well as Medicare. You have companies that put together the systems. Each state has a computer system for the Medicaid that they pay millions to these companies for, including Ross Perot's company, and many, many other stakeholders in the system.
To another caller here, we'll talk with somebody in Mohammed, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a close relative on Medicaid. She has never worked a day in her life. She gets everything paid by Medicaid. Everything. She gets medical. She gets dental. She's had caps put on her teeth. She gets township money. She gets rent. She gets food. She gets anything she needs. It allows her to have her hair done, with whatever money she gets on the side and celebrate her birthday in a large manner. I mean, she lives much better than I do on Social Security. she had shots that were given to her, that cost $2,000 a piece. So there are two sides to every question. And she has just reaped benefits from Medicaid that just blow my mind. I'd like to hear your comments.
Well, I think the idea of the Medicaid cheat, which was a big issue during the 1970s, the reality is that there are very, very few people that can actually cheat the program and get on Medicaid if they're not deserving. The amount of care and options that they get is quite limited in most states. I'm not quite sure what state you're talking about, but it's certainly not unlimited anywhere. And I suspect that your relative is bragging about getting her hair done and things, because I can promise you Medicaid doesn't pay for those kinds of things. And it's a relatively sparse program. Now, that said, it's better than not having insurance at all. And I would, so you have to be very careful what people say they're getting from Medicaid. There's a lot of exaggerations. But the Medicaid cheat is very difficult to do because there's very, very arduous regulations and rules that the states, do abide by. In fact, some people argue it's too arduous, that the documentation is much too difficult. So I suspect that she's exaggerating.
We just have about 5 minutes left here, and I want to, we've been talking a lot about the problems with the system and the fact that as part of the recent health care legislation, we're actually going to get more people into Medicaid, and no doubt that will magnify some of the kind of problems that we've talked about. I guess the question is now, where is it that you think we're heading with Medicaid? And generally, more generally, as you look at in your concluding chapter here with healthcare in this country.
Well, I think that we've made a start, and I think we've made a good start, but we've focused much too much on coverage. It is great to get near universal coverage, and I certainly support it. But from some of the things I've talked about earlier, I'm worried about access. I think flooding the system with 16 million new Medicaid participants without adding any doctors or requiring them to take Medicaid patients is going to be a huge, huge problem. I think flooding the system with all these new eligible participants onto the states, it's going to be a problem because they're going to end up cutting benefit packages and increasing costs. So I see some huge problems. I think it's going to be a bureaucratic mess dealing with some of these issues. But I don't want to be so negative because I'm glad we had health care reform, and I think it's a good thing that we're moving towards guaranteeing health care for people.
And do you think we're going to see a continuation of this trend, essentially, where what the federal government is doing is passing more and more of the responsibility over to the states?
Yes. The federal government is going to be funding a great deal of the reform in the early years. But more and more of the funding expansion populations are going to be put onto the backs of the states, and this is going to be a huge problem. What you see is a steady devolution of power to the states to control the programs. They got more power to control it in 2005. Most states have waivers now, so they could waive the federal rules and regulations. Some states have waivers to waive all federal rules and regulations. So, yes, you're right. There's much more power going back to the states. And I think this is going to be a problem especially for states who can't afford to abide by the mandates.
See if we can get a very quick comment here in the time that's left in McLean County, line number one. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm going to refer back to one of the gentlemen who talked about his 82-year-old dad who died last year and how the insurance company dictated, and Medicare dictated what kind of care he got. My comment is, isn't that what England does in a different way? And people threw a fit when we were first talking about, reform. You know, we don't want government telling us what to do, what not to do, but somebody does anyway. And thank you.
All right. I guess that goes to this question of what is and what is not rationing, and do we have it or do we not?
Well, of course, we already have rationing in this country, just simply by the fact if you can afford health insurance, you get it. If you can't afford it, you don't get it. Medicaid rations, Medicare rations. So we already have rationing. I think that's an issue that is overblown in terms of what would happen. The English system certainly does ration, but it only rations optional services. It doesn't ration necessary care. I think people really don't understand the English or the Canadian system.
Well, we're just about a point now. We have to finish up. Any sort of last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Yes, I think that we've made great progress in moving towards health care reform. I think that we need to now make it so that we can have actual decent treatment. I think for me the most important issue right now is cleaning up our nursing homes and getting more physicians to care for not only Medicaid patients, but all patients.
All right. And our guest, Laura Katz-Olson, professor of political science at Lehigh University, the book, The Politics of Medicaid, published by Columbia University Press. Professor Olson, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.